Greetings and welcome back to the Project Red podcast. My name is Brian, and with me, as always, is my friend and business partner, James Strong. How are you doing, James?
Really good, thanks, Brian. Taking each day as it comes. UK is back in lockdown again, and you know, I'm trying to take the positives out of it. And I've just had to spend so much time with my family and my daughter and see her grow up. So, you know what? Feeling pretty grateful today. How are you doing?
I was thinking about that the other day when you mentioned that the UK was going back into lockdown. I was like, that's great. At least you don't have to go back to work and you can stay with your brand new baby daughter. I mean, that really is a gift, man. When you think about all the parents that, you know, have to put their kids into childcare from, you know, the third week and then that's it.
So yeah, it's crazy. So yeah, absolutely. Been loving it. And I hear a lot of parents are experiencing the same. I think when you've got slightly older kids though, I think it becomes a bit harder work. And I think it's a bit of a celebration when schools went back, but you know, it's BAU in my household.
Awesome, man. Awesome. Well, I'm super, super excited about today's guest. Today is an old friend of ours, Seam Land. And for those that don't know Seam, which is, I mean, most of our audience will be familiar with Seam already. He's, you know, probably one of the most well-known biohackers on the planet, I'd say. He's incredibly knowledgeable. And what most fascinates me, he's also incredibly young. So I'm always so curious about his amazing achievements. Seam, welcome to the podcast. How are you, brother?
Yeah, what's up, guys? I'm glad to be on the show and glad to talk with you.
Awesome. So good to have you, man. We've bumped into each other a couple of times over the years, and I've got to see you speak a couple of times, and it's always blown me away how deep your knowledge is and how seemingly wide, you know, your knowledge seems to kind of go across the health and wellness landscape. How old are you right now, Seam?
I'm 26.
26. Yeah. Okay, and I'm curious to know, how did you end up where you are? Like, what was your past like, your childhood like, that kind of led you into this health and wellness sphere that you're in?
Right. Yeah. Well, how far back do I want to go? Like, which I would maybe start with, my childhood. Like, I was born in this small island in the middle of the Baltic Sea. It's called Saaremaa, and it's a very like a natural environment, and I was like growing up in the countryside, and that kind of, I don't know, enabled me to attain this mindset of wanting to, you know, live in a very like a natural way, and just be curious about the world around me. But during my college, I studied anthropology, and that's when I kind of got into like biohacking as a topic, and started to learn more about nutrition and diet. Before that, I was also like in the military for a year, and that's where I kind of also got interested in just like physical fitness and challenges and exposure to cold and any other kinds of stressors as a way to just build up mental toughness and fitness. I started my blog about those same topics of improving your health with that diet, different kinds of exercises, and just this biohacking topic. And it kind of grew on from there. I started my YouTube channel and wrote a few books and did my own podcast. And it's been growing ever since from there, just gradually.
Did you ever think when you were kind of, you know, when you first started with your blog and then, you know, the books and then the podcast, did you think that this was kind of a career that you might want to make, or were you just, you're just enjoying an interest of yours?
Well, I did have the intention of wanting to do this as a living, so to say, and because what I wanted to do was just share like information about let's say human optimization or human performance optimization, and how do you just achieve your potential as a human, whether that be with like biohacking or like mindset and just like self-improvement as a whole. That was like my goal, to share this information with the world. And the medium that I decided to pursue first was writing. So that's where I, you know, decided to start like my blog and decided to become like an author. And the other things, like making YouTube videos or podcasts, those things were they came more naturally as a way of, you know, because those mediums are very popular at the moment, and they're also like very effective ways of communicating. So I just added them into my like skill set, if that makes sense. So yeah, I did have like the intention of doing it. Like, I don't know, like maybe if I didn't have this goal, then I would maybe wouldn't have started like social media or something, because yeah, like for me it is kind of a main goal is to just share my information and yeah, use it as a tool, not like not like as an entertainment.
Yeah, that's a really great point there. Using social media as a tool and not as entertainment. I'm personally super conscious of that, because social media actually gives me anxiety. Like if I turn on my phone and I'm scrolling aimlessly, I'm not exaggerating, within 40 seconds or 2 minutes, I start to feel anxious, because I'm like, Jesus, like what the fuck am I doing? And then I switch it off, you know, and I don't. But like you say, as a tool, it's very important, you know. Obviously for Red Light Rising, social media is a big thing for us, and just sharing the knowledge out there. I'm always also curious to hear, what do you, if you come up to someone in the street and they say to you, like, what is biohacking? Do you have a definition that you usually use?
Yeah, I would say it's a like a modernized and scientific ancestral way of living. So it's a kind of combination of technology and science with ancient knowledge and wisdom. So it is like a very systems way of looking at health and human the human body, and using it to achieve like a particular goal. And almost like I would maybe like to, if I were to say like only a single phrase to describe biohacking, then it would be like modern alchemy, like you know, using whether that be some supplements or some other ingredients to achieve a certain I don't know, state of mind or a state of performance and physiological condition. So it is a way of just you know, the word manipulating may sound, you know, somewhat negative, but it is in a way that's exactly what you're doing with like red light, or with taking some supplements, or even like drinking caffeine. All those things are just manipulating your body for a particular effect, whether that be like fat loss, cognition, longevity, better sleep, better mood, and that sort of thing.
Mm. And that's also a great point, because, you know, I always, whenever we do a podcast, like, you know, we're doing one with you now, which I know you could take us down the deepest rabbit hole. But I always think about, like, what would, if there was someone that was listening right now that's never, this is their first time hearing about biohacking, this is the first time hearing about health optimization or ancestral stuff, I always try to make that connection, like you've just said. Like, the whole idea of health optimization is that you can choose to do something because of the scientific fact that will then cause your body to react in a certain way. You know, so the most basic one, I suppose, is you drink a coffee and you get that, you know, that sudden energy burst and that like mental cognition like fires on. So that's something I always try to share. Like, the reason why we do all these weird and wonderful things that on the outside, they look so weird to people. But the reason why we do them is because they do have these profound effects on our, like you say, our physiology, like biochemicals inside, like something's changing, something's getting better, something's being boosted, which is having a positive effect on our lifestyle. And I was telling my housemate before we got onto this podcast, I said to her, you've got to look at Seem's sleep numbers, because he regularly posts sleep scores with like 2 hours of deep sleep, 2 hours of REM sleep, heart rate variability that's nearly 200 milliseconds. And it's just like, I'm like, what the, like, my highest heart rate variability is like 75 on a good day. I'm like, look, 75. Can you tell us a little bit about your day-to-day habits, a day in the life of Seem?
Yeah, well, depends on the particular day. But I do, let's say, there are certain like non-negotiables that I do want to keep in my everyday. So this concept of non-negotiable is like a habit or a routine that I would do no matter what. This is because it's like I prioritize it a lot, and just to help me to, you know, maintain health as well as achieve my certain goals. So for example of that would be like some aspects of time-restricted eating or intermittent fasting. So I don't really eat, you know, three meals a day or something. I usually eat only, you know, on most days I eat like once a day, But on some other days, I maybe eat over the course of like 5 or 6 hours. So it's a relatively like a narrow eating window. So that's for me, like, of course, there are like a lot of health benefits to this, but I would also do it even if it didn't have any health benefits, because it's a very convenient way of eating. And for me, it gives me a lot of freedom and productivity. So that's why I do it. Secondly, I also try to do something physical every day, some form of exercise. On like a heavy workout day, I'll do like resistance training with weights or calisthenics, or some on like rest day, lighter day, I'll do maybe some like cardio, or I'll go like cycle around the island. And then I'll also maybe on some other rest day, I'll do like blood flow restriction training as well with these K2 bands. So I'll do like something every day. Whether or not it's going to be like a hard workout depends on like the overall weekly workout routine and what I did the previous day. So if I had like a hard workout the night yesterday, then I would do like a easy recovery day this day, and something harder again tomorrow. So it's always like cycling, but I generally try to get like a sweat on a daily basis, and the sweating can also come from like saunas. So I'll do like basically some form of this hyperthermic conditioning or a sauna, like almost like every day. I may skip like 1 to 2 days a week, but generally I do it every day, like whether that be with the infrared sauna or the traditional Finnish sauna. So I'll kind of use both of them. And in addition to the, like these health practices, I also do like Cal Newport has the concept of deep work, which is basically this undisturbed period of working where you are fully immersed by your this like most important thing that you need to do for that day, and just not being distracted by the outside world, and you're just immersed with the work. And my deep work period is usually the first thing I do in the morning, right after waking up. Like I'll go for a short walk, but I'll start working basically right after waking up, and I'll do it for like maybe 4 or 5 hours in a row to try to just kind of eat the frog, if that makes sense, to get the most important task of the day done when I don't have like other distractions and where my mind is the most fresh. So that's what I think I would be somewhat of like a regular day in my life. Like I would do work on my my writings and other things. I'll do exercise and some fasting, and just some form of like recovery with like saunas or ice baths even, and red light therapy is also there. So just doing both like a physical and a mental, let's say, exertion.
That's super interesting what you said there, because I've been playing around with my daily schedule as well, and I think I've been getting it slightly wrong, to be honest, because I wake up and I wanted to ask you, what time do you wake up, Sim?
Well, I wake up like maybe 6 or 7, something like that.
Okay. All right. So I'm waking up before the sun comes up. So it's still pretty dark, and I have a cup of tea, and then I slowly just kind of move around, do a few little chores, and then I relax and drink my tea while the sun is coming up. And then I've been kind of going for a walk on the beach and doing some mobility work on the beach and some stretches. And then, coming back and then maybe eating some food and then starting work. But I've been thinking the last couple of days that maybe I should do what you do and just have a very, very short morning routine and actually start work at like 6 a.m. and do, like you say, maybe 3 or 4 hours. But what's your position on working for such a long block of time? So you say like 4 to 5 hours in a row. Is that like 45 minutes of hard work and then 15 minutes just to walk around a little bit and then another 45 minutes? Or are you sitting down for 5 hours nonstop working?
Well, I think depends on the individual and how they like to work, or like maybe how their brain is wired. I do think like you can, rewire your habits as well as like your concentration habits. Like I used to also have like a more thorough morning routine. Like I would meditate for maybe like half an hour. I would do maybe like a few yoga poses. I would journal. I would have like a pretty longer morning routine and then get to work. But then I was thinking like I'll scrap it. So I felt like I didn't need to do all those things to stay productive and stay you know, in my zone for the rest of the day. So I just skipped it, and I haven't noticed like any difference. I've actually even felt better because of like, I'll get more things done, and I'll I feel like your routines should never be like, you shouldn't never feel that you need to have your routines in order to be optimal. Mm. You would want to be, you know, fully functional and fully optimized, even if you didn't get to do your routines, whether that be like, you should be able to focus on your work without having drunk coffee, or you should be able to, get things done without getting all your 8 hours of sleep. And you should be able to, feel great without, you know, checking your Instagram or something else to get your likes or something. So you always want to be in this anti-fragile position that no matter what happens to you, you're still able to perform and do the thing that you know you need to do. And it's so very much conditioned. Like it is a habit to be able to perform without your routines. And part of it kind of requires you to break up your routines every once in a while as well, to not be this very like dogmatic state that you have to follow everything to the T. You have to tick every box on your list of to-dos. You won't want to be in this position where you're able to do it even, you know, without doing those things and feel great regardless. So that's why I think, you know, breaking your routines is a good thing every once in a while. The way I like to do it is I just, sit down and I'll start working. I don't do it like this entire 5 block in one sitting. I may have like a few, movement breaks. I'll go outside for maybe 5 minutes to get like sunlight. That's also like a good practice of, going out frequently to get the circadian rhythm optimized and synchronized. I'll do like the vibration plate maybe to get my lymph flowing, and something that to kind of break the routine. But I don't break it for any longer than like 15 minutes or something. I personally don't think that I could be very effective if I do something like the Pomodoro technique, where you're working for only 20 minutes and you take a 10 minute break, because like 20 minutes for me is like I'm just getting started, so I'm like only warming up, so I'll have to take a break. So I feel like that would be like less effective for me, because the kind of things that I do is writing a lot and editing and creating content. So for me, I kind of need this longer period of kind of going into this focused state where I will be like fully immersed up by the thing, and I'll only take a break if I like get zapped out of this flow, or if I notice that I've been standing or for like too long.
I think one thing that's consistent across both your morning routines though is that exposure to nature in the morning. I think that's a really important thing. I know for me personally, if I get outside and do anything, not only is it relaxing, it's meditative, you're getting exposure to light, setting that circadian rhythm. I think that acts and kind of encompasses everything you try and achieve in terms of movement, light, and everything else. And as long as that remains, then I think that's a great consistent thing that we're seeing across everyone that we speak to, is that exposure to nature as soon in the day as possible. In your introduction, you're incredibly modest, and you just said, I've written a few books, but you've written almost, I think it's a dozen books or maybe more now. Is that right, Seem?
Well, some of them have like similar topics covered. I would say maybe, like at least five, what I would consider like actual books.
Right, okay. That's incredible for someone so young. And again, you've talked a lot about getting into that focused state. And I think that's like a flow state for you, when you're in the zone, you're focused. You know, is there anything you could share with our listeners about how you achieve that state? And is there anything you're doing or taking to really, hone in and be able to be that strict and diligent with your time to achieve, the great things you have already at such a young age?
Yeah, well, I think for me, it has been just the result of, sheer practice and a lot of repetition. It wasn't like something that I was born with, or like it definitely had to be developed to be able to focus a lot on one thing. I think that just the biggest thing is to just create this environment where you are, where it's easier for you to stay focused. So that would mean that you don't have your Instagram on, or you don't have your Messenger on. You don't have, actually, I keep my phone on like the airplane mode basically the first half of the day when I am working, so that nothing could disturb me. So it's like just like easier. You could try to like, I think like I can probably work like in a subway as well. Like I could probably write and in a subway where it's very noisy and when a lot of people are distracting me, but not if you're if you're struggling with this, then it's much easier to just make the environment as you know, focus friendly as possible. So that's why just controlling your environment is the first thing to do. I'm not a fan of, like, you know, yeah you could consume things like caffeine or some nootropics to enhance your focus, but I'm personally of the belief that I don't want to be dependent of any of these substances or any of these things. Meditation, I don't want to be in this spot where I need to meditate or where I need to take caffeine in order to be able to focus. I want the aspect of focus to come from my own just mindset and my own brain, if that makes sense. I want this to kind of be very, very natural as a part of my skill set. And the skill set is the result of my routines and habits. So I'm focusing mostly on just being consistent with it and, making it as a part of, like, my own way of being.
That's interesting.
Were you going to say something, Jay?
I'm reading a book by Jim Quick called Limitless, and he talks a lot about motivation and having a reason and a purpose, and that seems to drive people on. I mean, have you got your own purpose? Have you got something that underlying everything that's driving you to achieve these things?
I don't have, like, any like a real specific goal that I can identify, but it's more on the lines of I want to make sure that us as a human species don't mess up and we don't go into, like, this dystopian future where, like, you know because of, like, with the biohacking and biotech, there's a lot of potential for things to go wrong, and people can lose their freedoms and human rights because of, you know, big tech and whatnot. So I want to just make sure that when we go more of this into this future society, we don't mess things up. So that's kind of my goal of being a guardian or something that's gonna protect against people taking advantage of others and whatnot.
Awesome. I was going to ask you as well, I was thinking about this concept of, like, you know, what we, this biohacking, where we kind of, you know, we limit as much toxicity as we can, whether that's toxicity in the form of light or food or environments. You know, we, as biohackers, we tend to start looking at everything with how it affects our health and trying to make everything as good as it can be to be as healthy as we can be. But then that got me thinking, like, some of me can't help but feel that that's also a form of fragility. Because suddenly then, you know, you're looking around and you see everything as a toxin, you see everything as a problem.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the best way to be either. What do you think about that?
Yeah, exactly. I agree. So that you can really end up being afraid of everything. Like, you can be afraid of carbs, or you can be afraid of canola oil or EMF or whatnot. So that I would never want to be living in this sphere. And I do think that it does predispose you to more damage from those things. Like, if you are ruminating about the potential harms of 5G or these other toxins, then it kind of keeps you in this chronic low-grade stress all the time. And I believe, you know, fearing things and being anxious about those things would be probably a lot harmful than staying calm about it, so to say. Of course, you wouldn't want to deliberately expose yourself to, like, chemicals or these other toxins, but at the same time, you know, if it does happen every once in a while, then you shouldn't be, like, distraught about it or be afraid of it. So it does require a lot some aspects of, like, carefreeism, because, you know, at the end of the day, we are still going to die, and there's not gonna be it's gonna be pretty there's not gonna be a lot of things that you can do about it. And but when it comes to, like, less toxic things, like, carbs or cake, birthday cake, then that's actually, I think that can also be a good habit of anti-fragility, so to say, that you're not afraid of, eating birthday cake because it's, can be somewhat beneficial, and you're getting this small amount of, like, gluten, small amount of those carbs, and it can improve, like, your metabolic flexibility. And if you're like doing it consciously, then it can be also great, like a break for your mindset. So I do believe that constantly obsessing about things is not, like, the anti-fragile position.
It's it does really bring on that I love that phrase, the low grade chronic stress, you know, can be kind of summed up as worrying all the time, worrying about everything. And in fact, becoming fragile. I know some biohackers that I really like very much, but they are very fragile, you know, because of very real reasons, because they did have such horrendous health problems that what made them turn to biohacking. But you know, they're just so fragile that it's difficult to kind of spend. It's great spending time with them, but it's difficult because you can't just go out to a restaurant. You can't just go out to grab a coffee because it has to be the best coffee in the world. Otherwise, it's going to give me a headache.
Right.
You know, you can't just go and grab a steak because it's like, well, I don't know if this is grain fed. You know, it really upsets me. So it's definitely a form of fragility that, like, when I experienced it, I was like, whoa, like this, you know, this isn't good. So your time restricted eating, do you now, as part of the circadian rhythm, you know, I think one of the major markers of your circadian rhythm is the timing of your food. And I believe that it's recommended to have your meals, whether you're having one, two, or three meals a day, it's recommended to have them at the same time every day, because your body gets into that habit where it knows at 9 a.m. I'm going to have some food. How do you manage your time restricted eating? Also, it's a big question. Also, in regards to your training, are you consciously eating to suit the level of training you're doing?
Yeah, I do try to, you know, structure my meals around my workouts. So if I'm not working out, then I choose to just fast as a way to just take advantage of it, because I do believe that your, you know, demand for calories and food does increase in proportion to your like physical exertion and physical activity. So, you know, that's why I don't really eat throughout the first half of the day, because I don't do a lot of physical things. I only, you know, walk. I take some time off. I don't do like anything hard, and I only work out in the afternoon, or I do cardio at that point. So on most days I'll have like my meal around in the evening, maybe like 7 p.m. or something. And on some other days, I may have like some small lunch or some bone broth or something. But usually, yeah, it's my after my workout, which the workout itself is in the afternoon, maybe like 4 or 5 p.m. And the meal is then around 7.
And so would that for you, does that kind of signify the end of your day? So like you're finished working, you've had all your productivity, you do your workout, you have a big meal. And then the evening is just completely to relax, switch off, and enjoy. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, exactly. Like that's my kind of mindset is like I work hard, but I also take time to you know, rest and wind down. So I do. It's not like that. I don't like watch any silly videos on YouTube or something. I do watch them, but I do it only on my terms, or I do it during my time off. So I don't do it when I'm supposed to work. So yeah, like I think, you know, it's important to have downtime and especially in the evening. So I don't want to be in this very hustle, hardcore mode in the evening, because that's when the time where I'm supposed to go to bed soon and wind down. Mm. So it's a good opportunity to like relax a little bit and prepare for sleep.
Are you strict with the time that you go to bed?
It varies a little bit. On some nights I'll maybe stay up a little later, but I usually go to bed like maybe 10:30 is usually kind of where I would like to go to bed on most nights. But it's sometimes it may be 11, sometimes it may be 12 or something.
Is that because you decide to do some work, or is that because you're enjoying your downtime, so you're maybe reading a book and you just don't really think about it?
Sometimes I'll stay I'll you know do something. But nothing like work. But on sometimes I may do it like on deliberately as well every once in a while to again like break the routine, if that makes sense. To not because like with the sleep as well, I want to like there isn't a lot of benefits to sleep deprivation or changing your sleep routine. But I personally think that it can help me to stay again more anti-fragile in future scenarios where I would be sleep deprived. So if I do it like every once in a while at home, then I'm able to tolerate like jet lag and circadian mismatches through other means. Mm. And like even I can even like, you know, you know, I can sleep only for maybe like 2 hours or 3 hours and I'll be fine the following day. So it's like a does kind of condition your brain and body to handle some aspects of sleep deprivation. So I'll do it like in a similar way to try to kind of condition the body in a small amount.
Okay. That makes sense. James looks like he's got a question.
So I was listening to Dominic D'Agostino recently talk about his compressed eating windows and how he approaches it. And he says it's quite important to pulse these things. You know, your body is very intuitive and very, you know, over time will actually adapt to the stresses you're applying to it. So again, if you're constantly doing one meal a day every day, your body will get used to that, and kind of the major benefits of fasting for such a large window will diminish over time.
Yeah.
So how do you adapt, you know, a more sort of pulsed kind of stress response with your food? I know you mentioned bone broth some days, but do you some days have a breakfast just to mix it up to, again, to keep your body kind of guessing and, you know, instilling these benefits?
Yeah, I do think that there is some benefits to this variability and pulsation. But I think, for me personally, I can achieve that through other means as well. So like I can do like calorie cycling, for instance. I can do on some days I eat like very low calories, and on the other days or the following day I'll eat like slightly more calories. So that can also achieve this metabolic effect. So you prevent this metabolic slowdown, so to say. You're cycling between calories, and cycling with carbs is another form of doing it. So I eat relatively low carb on most days, but I also eat high carbs on other days. So I'll deliberately just like spike my insulin and blood sugar high as a way to break ketosis and cause, again, this metabolic disruption a little bit to force my body to adapt and maintain the ability to still burn carbs and glucose effectively. Mm. So you can do it with changing your eating window a little bit, but I think you can also achieve it with cycling your calories or cycling with your macronutrients.
Cool. So I do compress eating windows quite frequently, but one meal a day, I do find it hard to hit my macros for the day. And if I consistently do one meal a day for a week, for example, I'm dropping weight quite considerably, even though I'm, you know, eating as much as I can in that 1 or 2 hour window. You know, how have you found your body composition change, and how do you ensure on a daily basis you're hitting your macros and getting appropriate calorie intake?
You know, on keto, it's relatively easy because you can just get a lot of calories from less volume of food. Like there's a lot of calories in, you know, fatty meat or bacon and salmon, or you can even add like, you know, oils to your vegetables and kind of increases the calorie intake. So I've never had troubles, you know, keeping my weight or building weight or building muscle with the 1 meal a day. Maybe initially it was, you know, a slight drop in my weight because of not being used to eat that many calories in one sitting. But after a while, I kind of got used to it. And like there isn't like any like difficulties for me to do it at that point or at this point. Like if I want to drop calories, then I can do it very easily by just, you know, removing some of the fat from the foods and maybe focusing more on vegetables that are lower in calories. And the same with like carbs. You know, it's pretty easy to eat carbs. You know, even if I do lose weight, then I'll just eat more the following day or something. And, you know, I do get like in terms of protein, like the one key thing for, let's say, building muscle with one meal a day is that it's hard to stimulate enough muscle protein synthesis with just one meal. And you can't really, you know, there are studies showing that you won't, even if you do eat all your daily's protein in one sitting, you're not going to lose muscle at least. But in order to build muscle, then you would still need like an additional meal or an additional way to stimulate muscle protein synthesis more than just once a day. And for that reason, I drink like a protein shake during my resistance training workouts to get like a second spike in muscle protein synthesis. And that's what I found to be like the most effective way to still be able to build muscle with 1 meal a day. So I'm getting still two stimulus for muscle protein synthesis, even if I am, you know, eating the majority of calories in the evening.
Okay. Do you actively track your macros? Are you weighing food, and are you also like getting body scans to track your muscle growth, or are you just kind of doing it intuitively?
I don't weigh my food or something, but I'm like maybe somewhat, you know, subconsciously aware of the calories. Like I've done it in the past, and it kind of became like an automatic habit because it's just like a skill set, another skill set that you can look at the food and you can know approximately how much does it weigh or how many macronutrients does it have. So it's I don't do it actively, but I do it as a habit, and I don't like specifically count it, but I kind of intuitively feel, you know, how much, you know, food do I need. On some days, you know, the macros themselves are relatively different on different days. Like the range for protein is very variable, the range for carbs is variable, and the fats as well. So I don't really worry about that.
Okay. Were you going to say something, Steve?
Yeah, for the body scans, I haven't done any like real body scans. I've only maybe done a few events where I've been to where they scan it, but nothing like actively. I'll prefer to just maybe look at the mirror or something to see more immediate feedback.
Yeah, I think it's kind of I've not done a DEXA scan, but I've just done a 3D body scan about a month and a half ago, or whatever. And I did it like it's not part of this obsession that I have to know like how much muscle mass, how much body fat, but I just thought it was fun and interesting.
Yeah.
You know, because I've been kind of doing this biohacking for a while and messing around with fasting and time restricted eating, and I thought it would just be really, really fun to see how my body is shaping up and my body fat percentage and all that.
Mm. Yeah, I mean in hindsight, it would be pretty good, or like a good memory almost, where you would see like a progression from it, like a 10-year workout progression. That would be like something to be proud of, later in your life. But yeah, like people have a slightly negative connotation about tracking or technology and measuring, because they feel that it kind of degrades their humanity almost, that they feel that they're less human if they do track something, which I don't really agree with, because biohacking and measuring and technology can actually improve or make you more human by being like more aware of what's going on with your body and actually enabling you to implement that data into your life, so you can, you know, make your life better and make yourself more happier. Because like Peter Drucker said, what gets measured gets managed. And if you're always controlled by your intuition or something, then you may be leading yourself down like the wrong path. Like you how do you know if your intuition is right? It does feel right, but it may not be. Like it may be based upon like false experiences or false data. So you could develop your intuition, but in order to ensure that intuition is right, then you also need to have like some objective data and measurements that would like accumulate this knowledge and wisdom eventually that you're going to use.
And it can be a slippery slope, though. I know from my own experience, and like just like I commented to you earlier about your sleep score, I track my sleep with the Oura Ring, and I have been for quite a while. But I have to cycle on and off, you know, because when the first time I decided to cycle off tracking my sleep is because I would go to bed thinking about my sleep score, and I'd wake up and the first thing I do is check my sleep score. And it was always like, not high enough. You know, when it became negative, I was like, I'm tying so much potential joy to what my sleep score says. So then I quit it for a few months, and then I drastically changed some habits. So then I was like, I'm going to track again and see what happens. And then obviously I felt good because my new habits was increasing my sleep. But it definitely can be a source of frustration if you get too tied to the numbers, and you know, it comes back to that low grade stressor. If you're constantly seeing heart rate variability in the 40 milliseconds, it's like, oh Jesus Christ, you know, every day I'm like, oh my God. But, something that both myself and James are very I don't want to say obsessed with, but like very focused on lately is circadian rhythm, specifically using red light therapy as a circadian marker. And we're gonna very soon we're bringing out some blue blockers to kind of, you know, help people further optimize their circadian rhythm. And I've totally forgot where I was going with this. What was I gonna say about that? Oh my God. Oh yeah. I was going to say, I need some nootropics. I was going to say, what about your sleep hygiene? Because you have exquisite sleep numbers. And I wonder if that's, you know, mostly due to your sleep hygiene, or is there just you're lucky genetically to be getting such great sleep?
I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, my kind of circadian robustness. So say like I'm pretty young, and your circadian system is much more robust when you're young, and it gets more fragmented and weaker as you get older. And I think like I also have like high, you know, NAD levels, probably because NAD is the like a metabolite that is kind of governing a lot of the circadian rhythms. So I'm young, I have high NAD, so I'm like I can get away with a lot. So I don't need to have like everything fully optimized in order to sleep well. I can even get like 100 HRV if I sleep for like 5 or 4 hours. So you know, it's because of like because of my age, and I also do like all the other things right. Like I do fitness, I do saunas, I eat a good diet. I'm not overweight. All those different factors enable me to sleep better. And I do have like a pretty you know like a good sleep routine as well. So I do use the blue blockers in the evening to block out the blue light. I have a relatively like a consistent sleep wakefulness cycle, and
I missed that. What do you say?
Sleep wakefulness cycle or like a bedtime schedule, I don't like eat immediately before bed. I don't consume caffeine in the afternoon. And I get plenty of sunlight throughout the day. So that's what I think is the biggest thing. I did notice like when I started to use the blue blockers initially, then I got like a slight increase in my deep sleep scores, like a maybe 15% increase in my deep sleep just by using the blue blockers. So they do have a good effect, and I feel that they work.
HRV, the heart rate variability is what that stands for. It seems to be quite a powerful metric, you know, across all these tracking companies that are out there, you know, now offering these tracking services. Can you tell us a little bit about HRV and why it is such an important marker to keep your eyes on?
Yeah, certainly. Like it's like I said, it stands for heart rate variability, and it's the interval between your heart beats. So like a healthy heart isn't beating like a clock or a metronome. It's not like back, 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 back. It has like some variability. Like some beats have a few milliseconds in between the heartbeats, and some maybe longer or shorter depending. So it's always like variable. And the HRV measures this variability and gives you like a certain score. And usually like a low HRV is associated with like, you know, worse health and even increased mortality, whereas high HRV means that your body is like recovered, it's healthy, it's not stressed out. So if you are like in a very monotonous HRV or even like heartbeats, then it kind of indicates that your body is in a stressed out state. So it's beating very regularly, whereas when it's in a parasympathetic state where it's not stressed out, then it kind of enables the opportunity to, you know, skip a beat, or if that makes sense, like have like a slightly more variability.
Okay, that's super interesting. You recently posted a pic on your Instagram with one of Lee's t-shirts with a nasal, it says nasal on the t-shirt, and that's also something that, you know, I think is super cool. Mouth taping and the focus of people beginning to practice to breathe through their nose more. I've been mouth taping for a few years now and really loved it. But it's, you know, even a few years ago, it was like, wow, man, if you tape your mouth at night, you are crazy. And now it's, you know, it's coming around. It's like, you know, it's like blue blocking was 5 years ago. Like nobody was doing it. Now everybody's doing it. And it's really cool to see because it's, you know, it's these very, very powerful, very simple, very cheap tricks that people can do to improve their health. Have you got some highlights for us about the importance of nasal breathing?
Yeah, certainly. Well, kind of the basic overview would be that humans are kind of supposed to breathe through their nose the vast majority of the time. Only maybe not when you're not, or maybe only when you're exercising, you could breathe through your mouth. Nasal breathing, it has also like stimulates the vagus nerve and has like this parasympathetic effect. So it lowers stress, it improves blood flow by spooling up like nitric oxide in your forehead. So the leak can probably explain it a lot more scientifically, but basically, yeah, like there's this, like a pool of nitric oxide that accumulates here if you breathe through your nose. And that nitric oxide helps with blood flow and improves oxygenation throughout the entire body and lower stress again. So yeah, mouth breathing is, you know, pretty bad if you're doing it on a regular basis. And like sleep apnea is definitely, it can cause like sleep apnea and yeah, like just other chronic stress related problems.
Okay. And for people that are listening, mouth taping, I think I'm sure we've spoken about it briefly before, but basically mouth taping at night. Some people do it actually when they work out as well, just as a reminder to like, hey, I'm not breathing through my mouth, even through this workout. I think I commented on one of your posts a few weeks ago that I've started like practicing mouth breathing while I'm working out. And it's difficult, man, because when you're like, did I say mouth breathing? I meant nose breathing.
Yeah.
Nose breathing, and like when you're so out of breath and you're trying to like breathe through your nose, it feels like you just can't get enough air in. So I like, it's almost like I have to make this weird shape with my face so that my nostrils open up more so I can get more air going in my nostrils. But I actually felt this like sensation in my face, like these muscles around my head, it was like they were activating more. It was a really strange sensation, but you know, I could, it's definitely one of those like disciplined practices
Spartans used to have these exercises where you would drink a glass of water and you would run like a mile and you would come back and you have to spit the water into the cup again. So if there was like less water than you began with, then you got punished. So the idea was that you have the water in your mouth and you go for this mile run and you're not supposed to swallow it. So it's going to force this mouth, nose breathing. And also a lot of, you know, self-control and the discipline.
That's amazing. I actually do a lot of my cardio, low-level cardio, nose breathing exclusively.
Yeah.
Again, it's a really great method that you're not overly stressing your body, but again, you're putting that, you know, hypoxic stress in your body at the same time. So, you know, to be able to keep your heart rate that low in the fat-burning zone, and again, just low-level stress in your body, which allows you to train more and more frequently. So again, especially when I was coming back from injury, it's like a really good practice to adopt to just to allow you to do more volume and still get the cardiovascular benefits.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier on in our chat, I forgot to ask you, I think you said that on your lighter workout days that you're using blood flow restriction bands. I thought those were to like stimulate a heavier workload, not a lighter workload.
Mm. Well, they do. Let's say the blood flow restriction bands do mimic a hard workout in a way that they trick your body into thinking that it's lifting heavier weights than it is. But I can, you know, still modify it based upon that. So I'm not going to max out with the blood flow restriction bands. I'll keep at the lighter loads. But with the blood flow restriction bands, you can direct more blood flow into the limbs that you're training with, like the arms or the legs. And it does promote recovery. So like with the KAATSU bands, they have like a lot of studies where they treat, let's say, injuries and like, you know, bone fractures and broken bones, even where their limb or broken arm is put in a cast, and they can still stimulate blood flow into the region and stimulate the muscles with these KAATSU bands. Without like, you know, doing exercise, and they maintain more muscle during this period of inactivity, and they also recover faster because of, you know, the increased growth factors that get released into the tissue. I personally find them also useful for, you know, muscle hypertrophy as a thing. So I would use them for both goals. I think they're pretty awesome, and especially if you don't have access to like heavy gym equipment. Mm.
Now, so can you, this is going to be a stupid question. Can you only use them in your arms and your legs, or is there like some kind of an adaption for the chest or what?
No, they do go around only the arms and the legs. So you can do like, you know, push-ups with it, or you can do like shoulder press or triceps push down, but they do work like a little bit of the chest, but the main region that they focus on is the arms and the legs.
Okay.
Joe McCullough is a big fan of blood flow restriction training, and he says especially for older athletes who can't do the heavier weights, it's a great way for, you know, the older generation to make sure that they're maintaining their muscle mass, as it does stimulate that hypertrophy growth. So again, if you cut, you know, if you don't have access to large weights, or you just using bodyweight exercises, or if you are just, you know, slightly more fragile in your older age, it's a great way to maintain that muscle mass. Maintain, you know, as you know, muscle mass and longevity are very strongly correlated. So again, it's just great for overall health, you know, if you're applying that approach as well.
Yeah, exactly.
You have a new book out, which sounds very, very cool. I am down in Guatemala, so it's virtually impossible to get hold of books down here, unfortunately. But Stronger by Stress, that's a super cool name. And what's this book about, Sim?
Yeah, well, it covers these beneficial stressors, like hormetic stressor. Hormesis describes the positive beneficial stress that in low amounts is beneficial, but in large amounts can still be harmful. So these different, exercises, an example of this hormesis, fasting, saunas, cold, and other things as well. So the book is just about the concept of hormesis and how do you implement these different strategies for becoming, you know, healthier, stronger, more resilient, and anti-fragile.
Okay. That's super cool. And what do you know much about, like, there's a concept in this biohacking space about stacking your hacks. So it's like combining one or two or three, you know, so-called beneficial habits to do them all at the same time, to have maximum benefit in the least amount of time. Do you know much about the science behind doing these things together? So for example, I know it's a fantastic idea to do your meditation while you get your red light therapy. But now that more and more people are getting into cold exposure, saunas, red light therapy, and fasting, is there anything that we should be aware of? You know, can we, for example, do a sauna and red light therapy? Can we do cryo and red light therapy? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah. Well, I can give you like an example it is like a pretty good idea to, let's say, if you do sauna, then it's also good to do it in a semi-fast state, because first of all, like the sauna itself or the heat stress is going to release growth hormone, which is, you know, lowering the catabolic stress of fasting, and basically you're going to burn more fat and lose less muscle if you do sauna in a fast state. But at the same time, the fasting can also protect some of the negative side effects of too much heat. So during heat stress, you do like release certain, you know, signaling molecules such as like heat shock proteins that repair damaged proteins and, you know, mediate some of the benefits from the heat stress. But at the same time, you also release some other like negative things like these stress granules. And if those things begin to accumulate in large quantities, then that can, you know, make you more susceptible to some diseases, but you can eliminate that with autophagy. Autophagy gets stimulated with the heat, but it also gets stimulated with fasting. So if you basically go in a sauna while you're fasting, then you have higher autophagy, which will kind of actively eliminate these negative byproducts of the heat stress. So yeah, it's a kind of double win that you get the increased growth hormone from the sauna that's going to protect against the also catabolism of fasting, while at the same time the fasting itself will protect against the negative side effects of the heat.
Okay. What about cold? Is there anything that people can do, you know, if they've got a cold exposure practice? Is there like another example you can give of combining hacks in that way? Would fasting be good for that as well, or is that a different story?
The cold also releases those same stress granules, and autophagy can eliminate it as well. It doesn't necessarily have to mean that you do have to do it like in a strictly fast state, but I really think that it should mean that you shouldn't do it with like a full stomach or like right after having eaten. So maybe waiting at least a few hours after a meal is then when you should do like a sauna or a cold. But you know, doing the cold in a fast state is also fine. And fasting promotes the activation of brown fat, and so does the cold exposure. So there may be somewhat of a more fat burning effect if you do it in a fasted state.
What's your thoughts about doing cold exposure after training? Obviously, you know, you don't want to blunt the the stress of exercise and the growth factors there. Is there a threshold people should not breach, especially on that?
Yeah, there is some research showing that it may not be the best idea to blunt the inflammation right after exercise, especially if you're doing resistance exercise. But it may depend on how much you're doing. Maybe a short cold shower wouldn't be a problem. But if you're going into the ice bath for 10 minutes, then it probably will just shut down the inflammation and inhibits some of the muscle hypertrophy signal. So what I personally do is I don't do any colds after my resistance training because if I were to do the cold, then I would do it maybe in the morning or after cardio, because it doesn't appear to interfere with the cardio vascular adaptations as much, because with the muscle growth itself specifically is the inflammation that is part of the signaling for the increase of muscle. So that's why you need some of the inflammation. I would do the cold only after cardio or in the morning to kind of lower inflammation.
You need to create quite a bit of a time gap between those different stresses, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I would maybe imagine that, at least a few hours, maybe 6 hours is probably something that you would want to aim for at least. And, optimally maybe 8 or 12 hours. That's what I would do anyway.
I agree with you. I remember Mark Sisson a long time ago wrote, either I read it on one of his blogs or I heard it on one of his podcasts, but he was saying the same thing about doing your workout and then immediately after your workout, taking a giant protein shake that's, high in protein, high in carbs. Because he was saying the same thing. He was like, well, look, you do this workout, okay? So you stimulate all these these growth hormones and all that through your workout. But then if you go and take your protein shake straight away, you're basically switching off that muscle building response and you're turning on digestion, because it's got to then divert all the energy and whatever else to the digestion part. So he recommended that, sometimes you stay fasted after the workout and do your workout and then just take care of something else, then maybe 4 hours later you have a meal. Is that anything that you've thought about or written about?
Certainly. So I think it depends on how long have you been fasting for and what your goals are, or what kind of a workout did you do. So I personally haven't noticed any negative side effects to fasting after a workout if I do cardio or if I do blood flow restriction training or something easy, because the kind of stress from that workout is relatively small. And but I do notice if I fast after a workout, after having done resistance training heavy weights, then I may notice at least I'm not going to progress as fast as I could if I did have something relatively close after a workout, because I also work out a semi-fasted state. So If you ate something before the workout, then you don't really need to worry about, jogging down a protein shake right after finishing, because you already have some protein and amino acids in your bloodstream from the previous meal. But if you do work out in a fasted state, then I would recommend to, at least maybe 4 hours is the maximum that you could get away with. But optimally, I would say, 2 hours is something that would be a safe range when you should eat at the workout.
I remember when I was a young dude and I was way before biohacking or any of that, I didn't know anything basically. And I was going into the gym and just working out in the gym with whatever I thought was the best thing to do. And then I remember there being this, at that time, the rule of thumb was you have to take your protein shake within half an hour of finishing your workout, because this is this prime window for carb uptake or whatever else. Is that is that still true?
Yeah,
that's it. Is that still true?
Well, yeah, it refers to this anabolic window, but I think it also depends on what did you do beforehand and what your overall diet like. So it may have an effect if you're in a very severe calorie restriction like you're already malnourished or you're deprived of calories and especially protein. But it wouldn't matter if you're like eating a sufficient amount of calories and you're already eating like a relatively higher protein diet. So it's not going to be that effective then. But, you know, but at the same time, if your goal is absolute maximum muscle hypertrophy, then that's why one part of the reasons why like bodybuilders eat like 6 times a day is to just spike the muscle protein synthesis as frequently as possible. So if you have like one meal or one spike of that coming from a protein shake after a workout, then it kind of checks the box at least for this one meal. So it depends on the goal and who you're talking with. But for the most people, most average people, they don't probably see a huge difference unless they are, let's say, under eating calories or protein.
Okay, brilliant. And do you ever see anything like, you know, if you are spending a bit of time on Instagram or you're jumping around on YouTube videos or whatever, do you ever see anything that you think is like, that's a bad idea? When you see someone doing like two biohacks together or trying something new, is there anything that's, maybe there's something that's trending right now that you're thinking this is not a good idea?
Well, there's always like, you know, these gym fails of people doing exercise on a balancing ball or something of that. So I think like, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, real world benefit to doing those things. Like you could, you know, train balance and you could train strength, but it's probably not the best idea to combine it. Like you can do it separately and it'd be more safer. And maybe like I will also add like these just overall trend of with intermittent fasting, for example, of trying to fast as long as possible, sort of thing. That's also like something not, you know, really, there's not a real reason to do it if you're already doing intermittent fasting on a regular basis or you're eating like a huge diet and you don't need to like go on this very long, like especially like this very long fast, like 10-day fast or 12-day fast or something. Maybe like an occasional 2 or 3 day fast is good, but you probably don't need to fast any longer than, you know, 5 or 7 days. And one thing I may also add is like, well, like the eat, like just with like keto and carnivore diets, you know, I agree that cholesterol and saturated fat themselves aren't necessarily harmful, but if you eat those foods or those nutrients, ingredients in the context of like the standard American diet with the, you know, processed vegetable oils and refined carbs, then they probably will be harmful because that's the kind of the recipe of the standard American diet already, where you're eating this high amounts of carbs and fats together. But it's not that meat and you know, eggs and cholesterol are bad. It's just that they are bad if you eat them together with these other foods. And it's better to, if you do eat those foods, then make sure you don't eat these other inflammatory foods that will oxidize the fats and oxidize the cholesterol and promote, you know, atherosclerosis. So if you eat like, you know, these keto foods, then you probably would have to do it with like a lower carb meal and not with these inflammatory oils.
And that's, you know, that could be another podcast in itself, is the processed keto food that is now coming out. You know, I mean, I remember when I first started going keto, like everything I've ever done, you know, when I was vegetarian, when I was bulletproof and then keto and now keto carnivore, like it's always just whole foods, natural whole foods. You know, when I was eating a little bit of vegetables, I was just eating vegetables and fat and meat. That was it. But then very soon after I went keto, which is, you know, nearly 3 years ago now, then, you know, obviously the whole world went keto and then all the keto treats started coming out and all the keto processed food, like the little fat bombs that you can kind of buy in the supermarket and take away with you. And I was like, this is not going to be good, man. You can't package up whole foods and put them in a bag and then still call them a keto something, you know? I was saying to, a friend of mine the other day, I did a podcast with a guy called Coach Jay Matos. He's a keto coach down in Panama. And when I was with him in Panama, actually, there was, you know, someone came up to us and gave us this whole selection of these keto bakery treats, like all these keto donuts and keto chocolate chip cookies and whatever else. And the ingredients is like, on paper, the ingredients is like, okay, this is almond flour and whatever, sugarless this and whatever that. But as soon as I ate it, my brain still thought that I was eating candy and my craving just kicked in instantly. And I was just like, this can't be good, man. Right. If you're trying to go keto and you're eating these keto snacks, I felt that it was still messing with my brain. Right.
Well, I think they're better than you know, the alternative, or the already, you know, they're better than regular candy bars and regular donuts or whatnot. Yeah. So they are, like, I do like that they provide like the alternative, and you can still have your cake and eat too, figuratively speaking. So, you know, but at the same time, like, the problem isn't the food. The problem is more like the relationship with the food or the attachment to foods, because I know many people who can eat like these you know, junk foods, and they're fine. They don't get the cravings, they don't get like these massive swings in their mood or whatnot. So you know, it's a part of, like, because if you are like on a very restrictive diet, then you occasionally have something off the menu, something, you know, very treat, something very tasty, then you do experience this massive hedonic response, because you're not used to it. Like, it's actually like a normal physiological response. Like a hunter-gatherer, if they come across a beehive, they're gonna eat the entire beehive because they haven't had like sugar and honey in months or weeks. So it's a very natural thing, and it's supposed to happen. So that's why I don't think it's a very, like, well, at least like I personally don't prefer to be on a, like, a very restrictive diet for the rest of my life, because I think that these foods are bad for me, so to say. Whereas in reality, it's just a matter of moderation and, you know, not being, let's say, too stimulated by them. So if you're used to having them every once in a while, then you also avoid this, you know, trap where you are in a, like, binge or a craving, a trap, so to say. You can avoid it if you, let's say, have your cake every once in a while.
100% agree. And like you say, it's also beneficial for, you know, to spike that blood sugar every now and then, just to spike that growth hormone.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you treat or how do you handle, manage your social life? I mean, do you go out in your town or on your island regularly? And when you do go out, are you still full on 100% sticking to your values, or are you just chilling out a little bit?
Well, if you mean by my values, that, well, I don't, like, I don't drink alcohol, I don't do drugs, I don't smoke cigarettes, so like, I don't have like these kind of temptations, and like the people that I, you know, communicate with, they're kind of fine with it. I don't like, you know, judge other people for doing it. I just prefer to do it. I like it to be like, it's also a challenge, sort of, say, if you're you know, forced to go into social settings while being sober, then it's a harder for a little bit, but it's also like more fun in some aspects. Like, it's another kind of fun game that you can play. But yeah, I think it's good to, you know, break the routine every once in a while as well. But and again, it can be like a form of this hormesis or this anti-fragility, that if I do go into like a nightclub without my blue blockers, then I can still, like, you know, I can like deliberately disrupt the circadian rhythm, and I cannot be like distraught about it, and so I can practice like this stoic mindset, so that I'm not like, I don't need my blue blockers, or I don't need to have my 8 hours of sleep to be happy or functional.
And then, so let's say, for example, because I'm finding that, because I've got a pretty strict schedule right now, and that is that I go to sleep at about 8:30 p.m. and I wake up between 4 and 5. I wake up between 4 and 5, and then I kind of get out of bed at like 5:15, something like that. And I'm just, I think that when I go back to, like, quote unquote, the real world, because I'm in a very small little town, and when I go back to the real world and I have to, for the sake of, you know, socializing and shifting my sleep patterns, do you get into bed then, let's say after a nightclub, the once in a while nightclub session, do you get into bed like wired? Can you feel, you know, the artificial light? Can you feel that your melatonin is seriously stunted?
Yeah, I do notice it like a little bit. Like the blue light especially, so your eyes are kind of like fired up a little bit. I think it's just that it's not that I'm like hypersensitive to it, it's just that other people are very used to it, so other people don't know the difference, what it feels like to block out blue light. And you know, if you do it like on a consistent basis, then you notice the difference. But I don't find it difficult. I don't find it that it affects my sleep in a negative way. Like, I can still fall asleep relatively quickly, because, like, you know, if I were to be out late, then I would also probably, you know, walk around a lot more, so I'd be like tired physically, so it kind of just imposes another stressor, because it, like, I can probably like fall asleep in basically any position, or like in any environment. Like, I can fall asleep in an airplane, I can fall asleep in a ditch somewhere I can fall asleep in a very loud, noisy environment on the floor or whatnot. So I don't like, I personally don't need like a, you know, fluffy bed or, you know, blankets to fall asleep.
Yeah. Okay. You're lucky. I had a friend that, I swear to God, man, every time we got on a bus, he'd fall asleep. And the bus ride was like 5 minutes and he'd fall asleep. I'd be in the middle of a conversation and I look at him and he's sleeping.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
That's amazing. I think I was the total opposite. So I've always been a poor sleeper since I was a child, basically. And the reason I got into training so much and doing like extreme triathlons and Ironman and things was because I needed to build up the sleep debt. Mm. I needed to like create myself, you know, train myself to exhaustion.
Yeah.
And then I'd go to sleep within, you know, 20, 30 minutes. Whereas now, by respecting circadian rhythms, by using blue blockers, by, you know, getting morning sunlight exposure, I've got my latency down to under 10 minutes, like quite frequently now. And again, that's like pretty optimal. And so for me, I didn't know how responsive I was to light. And then all of a sudden, blue blockers, using red light as well in my environment, boom, sleep just improved dramatically. Yeah. Like, it was like, I was surprised, but you shouldn't be. That's what we're wired to do, isn't it? To listen to those light cycles and respond to it.
Yeah, like what I think, one of the things that you said is exactly the reason I think I fall asleep so fast is like I build a lot of the sleep debt. So I am physically active, but at the same time, I also don't sleep very long if I do sleep. So I, like on most nights I sleep, you know, seven hours or something is my average. So I do have like a small sleep debt already by default. So that's why I'll, you know, maybe take a nap throughout the day, but I'll also be able to just fall asleep faster during the night. So I don't remember the last time I slept for like 9 hours or something. So usually it's only like seven, and that's why I think my body just wants to fall asleep a little faster.
Mm. Are you I mean, COVID has obviously been for the last, it feels like COVID's been for our entire lives now. But what about when you travel long distance? Have you got anything in particular that you kind of specifically do when you know you're going to be changing time zones?
Yeah. The kind of biggest thing that I focus on is just fasting. So I always fast if I fly on an airplane or I go into like another time zone or another place, because that the fasting itself, first of all, it protects against some of the like radiation and the EMF that you get exposed to in an airplane. Secondly, also just kind of bolsters your I personally feel it bolsters like your immunity as well, so you get like less sick if I'm traveling. And lastly, it does kind of help with the circadian rhythm adaptation as well. So if you know, land into a new time zone, for instance, if I go from, you know, Tallinn to LA, then like my metabolism and circadian rhythms are in a semi-suspended state, and I can basically adapt to the time zone of LA faster by eating there, because then my body receives the signal that it's okay, it's daytime in that time zone. Kind of helps me to enter into that new time zone more easily because of the fasting. So my metabolism, if I'm fasting, then my metabolism is just kind of waiting for the food. And when it does arrive, then it kind of usually happens, you know, you're doing daytime. So it kind of, the body goes, okay, it's probably daytime.
Hmm. Okay. That makes sense. I think we're almost ready to wrap up this podcast, unless James has any interesting questions he's left in his pocket.
I think we've covered everything pretty comprehensively. Thanks.
Okay. What's the next big thing for Seam Land? What's your next goal, or what's your next fascination?
At the moment.
Or is it top secret?
Well, I am pretty much wrapping up with my next book as well. And it's going to be co-authored with someone else. And it's going to be probably maybe, you know, around the end of 2020 or beginning of 2021. We'll see. But that's what I've been doing for the last month or so. But other than that, I'm still, you know, continuing on to just increase my, like following and just spreading the information.
Cool. All right, man. Well, we finish off with a couple of quick fire questions, just some little tidbits of information that we'd like to get from you. Don't have to give it too much thought, but can you tell us if there's one piece of advice that you could go back to, let's say, 13-year-old Seam, what would you tell it? What would you tell yourself?
Well, I think probably for that time period, I would have said, like, don't put like that much credit on the opinions of others or something that you you probably shouldn't, or it's not worth it to, you know, you should focus only on just improving yourself, not trying to fit into like the expectations of others or something. Because that at that time period, like, you know, teenagers or children, they don't have that much like self-awareness, especially like, so, you know, awareness about how social dynamics work or something. So that's what I would probably have said or given advice to.
Okay, that's great advice, that. Your best or favorite book that made an impact on you?
Well, I think my favorite book of all time is Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. So yeah, like Viktor Frankl was a Holocaust survivor. He was in Auschwitz, a psychiatrist. And he kind of wrote the book about explaining why or how certain people managed to survive those situations because of they changed their perspective on it, and they kind of found some like additional meaning. So the other people who were thinking that they were just suffering and that they were just being, it was like injustice, of course it was, but at the same time, they were also, they kind of, they didn't have like a bigger meaning to live for, whereas the others who found this meaning, they kind of found more fire that kept them going, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, that is a great book. Your favorite bit of technology that you're using right now, it can be health related or something else?
Maybe the Katsu bands are something that I enjoy the most. Well, I've used like the Oura Ring for, you know, years. So like probably the Oura Ring would be like my number one thing that I like to use just because of the, you know, data and the benefits it has on your sleep. Not necessarily wearing the ring, but just getting like the feedback and knowing how to tinker with it. That's the good thing. But yeah, like my current, like for the past few months has been the Katsu bands.
Cool, I'm definitely gonna give those a try. And your best, I think I know what you're gonna say with this, but your best or favorite hack or habits that you do daily or semi-daily?
Yeah, well, my kind of favorite thing is intermittent fasting, but I also think like sauna is probably equally as good. So yeah, the sauna is a pretty awesome thing.
Do you have a sauna at your house?
Yeah, I have the infrared sauna and the kind of traditional wooden heated.
You've got two saunas at your house.
Yeah.
Which one do you use the most, out of interest?
Well, I use the infrared sauna more because it heats up faster and it, you know, it's like in and out. Whereas with a traditional sauna, you have to kind of fire it up for like, you know, an hour at least or two. But, you know, the feeling is better for the regular sauna, but the infrared sauna is just like a good thing to do like on maintenance and as a, like a regular routine.
Beautiful. So now James has got an amazing sauna. Seam's got two saunas. Everyone we talk to, they keep saying, I love my sauna. I've just got a sauna. I love my sauna. And now I'm like, God damn, man, I need to get a sauna. And maybe I should get one of those saunas that you can, there's like little, what do they call, right, a little personal sauna?
Box. A
little,
it's like bag. A sleeping bag. You can like lay on the bed with it. And they're only a few hundred dollars. So I think there's some good options out there.
Yeah, well, you do sweat probably there.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I do. I don't know who I was listening to. Maybe Rhonda Patrick, someone like that. But they were saying that like you can get an equivalent, well, I don't know if equivalent, but you can get a similar effect as you can with a sauna just by training in a very, very hot environment or just being in a hot environment. You can stimulate the same kind of heat shock proteins.
Yeah, like exercise releases those heat shock proteins as well. And especially like higher intensity things. Or yeah, like just anything that kind of gets you sweating is going to do it. But, you know, a particular exercise that I find especially suited for that would be like the hot yoga. You know, you're doing it in like a small room and you're sweating more. So that, because the was it eccentric contractions or not? Mm-hmm. The static holds. Those are very kind of demanding on the nervous system, and they also release more of these heat shock proteins.
It's interesting. I got to do that. And the very, very last thing we've been doing on our podcasts, just kind of a little bit for fun, but also because I think it's very important. I know you're a fan of Stoic philosophy. So I read, I don't know, maybe you read it too, but I read the Daily Stoic by Ryan Holiday and Stephen Hanselman. Basically, it's just a page a day of a little nugget of Stoic wisdom. So we kind of, I just read a short paragraph, and if you guys want to, you know, comment or anything, then we're obviously welcome to comment. So today's topic is called Count Your Blessings. We regularly covet what other people have. We desperately try to keep up with the Joneses, all the while the Joneses are miserable trying to keep up with us. It would be funny if it weren't so sad. So today, stop trying to get what other people have. That's like me trying to get sleep numbers like Sina. Fight your urge to gather and hoard. That's not the right way to live and act. Appreciate and take advantage of what you already do have, and let that attitude guide your actions. I think that's awesome. That sounds to me like just like a gratitude practice, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We might think that, you know, the grass is greener on the other side or something, but it doesn't. You shouldn't like really. Well, that's what one of the core teachings of Stoicism is, that you shouldn't let your happiness be dependent of these external things, whether that be mm-hmm. you know, possessions or even like other people or, you know, social gratification or whatnot. So you would always need, or you know, even just your own you just being there should be sufficient for you to be happy.
Yeah, and it's that little shift of perception, because like, okay, classic example. Now I was just saying, oh, I'm so jealous you guys both have saunas, and then I'm like, yeah, but I live at the beach, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Or, you know, I could think of 10 things that I'm like, oh yeah, but I've got it pretty good, you know, there's right. no need to worry about getting a sauna. Thank you, Seem, so much. It's been absolutely amazing talking to you, as always. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely.
Thank you, James, for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah,
as always, thank you.
And thank you to everyone who's listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, we would love it if you could leave us a little review, either on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcast. It really makes a difference. There's an incredible back catalog of podcasts if you want to catch up with some other amazing guests. And of course, there's always some amazing guests coming. Thanks for listening, guys, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.